First case on the docket is Jonathan Marquis Holly versus the Commonwealth, Ms. Ringer and Ms. Tyson. Good morning. Ms. Ringer, do you want any time in rebuttal?
I will waive that, Judge Felton. Thank you. I'll rely on what I have to say here, and anything that's unsaid, I'll rely on brief if I may.
You may.
May it please the court, and I will say to the court, as I've said to the panel, this is an issue that has had my brain tied up in knots for quite some time. The issue before the case would seem to me fairly straightforward. It's a double jeopardy question. Mr. Holly was charged at trial in two separate counts, one count charging generic first-degree murder, another count charging felony murder, murder in the commission of, in this case, it was burglary. The case went to the jury on both with separate sets of instructions, which I think had that not occurred, we wouldn't be here today. But the end result, Mr. Holly was convicted under both counts. He was found guilty of second degree, what we call second degree generic murder under the first count, under the basic murder. And then he was found guilty as charged of first degree felony murder.
Counsel, the multiple punishments subset of double jeopardy, that is essentially a determination of the intent of the lawmakers.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
Well, if the common law is being incorporated into these common law offenses, then wouldn't it be natural for us to look to the common law to determine the intent of the lawmakers with respect to multiple punishments?
Yes, sir. I think we begin there, and I take it that was why the court requested the supplemental briefing on the common law and the two cases, the Wicks and the Livingston case. And, you know, when we go back to the common law, we go back to Blackstone. As I argued on brief, you know, murder was murder. It was automatically punishable by death. We evolved into this more refined or more civilized manner where we said, all right, you know, murder is murder, but there are different, not different, offenses. And that is the crux of Mr. Holly's argument this morning.
Well, in your analysis, then, If felony murder was not a common law crime, would that change your analysis?
I'm not sure it would change my analysis, Judge, because I believe it was. But I guess my starting point, and I may not be articulating this clearly this morning, I apologize. What we ended up with in the older case law, Wicks and Livingston, to me that's clear, perhaps because I think it supports my position, that the courts there said, the legislation, we go back to the first code, I believe it was 1819, where it says murder, willful, deliberate, premeditated, or by poison, starving, lying in wait, or, and it goes on to talk about what is basically felony murder. It says it's all murder in the first degree.
Well, Ms. Ring, is it your position that second degree murder is a lesser included offense to first degree murder?
I think strictly applying the Blockberger test, in this situation, I don't think it is.
In fact, there was a concession that it was not at the trial.
It was, after much argument and briefing at the trial level.
How can it not be a lesser included offense? What element is present in first degree murder that's not present in second degree murder, vice versa?
In first degree generic murder.
I saw a felony first degree murder.
Okay. In felony murder, we have the implied or imputed malice that comes from the associated underlying felony.
So it's your position that malice is not an element of felony first degree murder?
I think it is, but not a separate specific element. And
It clearly is under Wooten. Under Wooten, the Supreme Court said that neither premeditation or intent to kill is an element of felony murder, but malice is.
Yes.
So what element is now lacking in second degree murder?
Well, second degree is a killing committed with malice. Now, I note, and again, I apologize, Judge, I may not be responsive. This is where my brain goes into total convolutions. I think the Attorney General was attempting in her brief to draw some distinction between the types of malice.
But the point is, malice is imputed in one, and malice has to be found separately in the other, but the same element is present, malice.
Yes, it is malice. Again, to me, the easy argument for Mr. Holly is second degree is, in fact, clearly, plainly, a lesser included of first degree, and therefore both of these cannot stand.
Well,
his attorney conceded
that.
Stop
right there if you just would. Because it seems to me that your argument is, if it is not a lesser included offense, then they're separate offenses. And he could be convicted of both. If it is a lesser included offense, then it seems to me that Buchanan takes care of the whole problem, where Buchanan says that you simply vacate the conviction for the lesser offense and impose the sentence for the greater. So which is it?
My basic argument, and I believe this is what I argued in my initial brief to this court, is that it is a lesser included. My issue, and again, if I'm wrong, I apologize, but my issue, and I know the Attorney General very correctly, I think, jumped on this, is that Mr. Holley's trial counsel at oral argument following the filings of the briefs and opposition brief in support at the trial level, his attorney floored me when I read it in the transcript. He said, I have to concede it's not a, that second degree is not a lesser included. It is still, and I'm not being totally responsive, I apologize, Judge, but my position is, even if we're going to say that I am bound by that concession, my position is that by convicting of second degree and first degree felony murder, we are still convicting and therefore punishing Mr. Holley twice for the same offense.
But if we vacate that second degree murder conviction, then there is no double jeopardy violation.
Yes, sir, and it's our position. One of these convictions, Mr. Holley's position, my position, one of these, and the associated use of firearm, must fall.
Well, not just one, always the lesser, never the greater.
That is the case law. I can't dispute that.
Can I take you back to a point you made a moment ago?
Yes, sir.
Even with your concession by trial counsel under the Blockberger lesser included analysis, if the common law clearly identifies for the court the intent of the lawmakers, and we have the common law intent, and we also have the reception statute in Virginia that adopts the common law as
yes.
it then existed at the time of Blackstone, is it even necessary to do a Blockberger analysis?
I don't think so. In my position, and again, I hope I made this clear in my supplemental brief, my position is that we don't even reach Blockberger in this case because all of these offenses are encompassed under 18.232, which springs from the common law. And 32 tells us murder, if it's committed by, again, willful, deliberate, premeditated, or, you know, lying in wait, poisoning, starvation,
so since we
or felony, it's all murder.
Not to abrogate in whole or in part the common law, and there's no express statement in any of these statutes changing the common law rule of multiple punishments, doesn't that cut right to the chase?
I think it does, and part of my argument is that, again, to me, perhaps because I want to see it this way, but perhaps I'm being too simplistic, but I think, again, 32 on its face is clear. And we certainly know if the legislature intends to specifically create or describe different offenses, we know that the legislature knows how to do that. We have the basic involuntary manslaughter statute. We have DUI manslaughter. And of course, the DUI manslaughter statute makes it very easy. There's a proviso in there that specifically says you can convict under this that doesn't preclude under the other. Nowhere in 32, and again, going back to the common law and the cases, Wicks and Livingston and the various, what are we up to, four, five, six editions, if I may, of the code, I see nothing there that tells us anything that the legislature intended to create separate and distinct offenses. So therefore, what we have in this case, and I'm putting the lesser included issue aside because my concession scares me, quite honestly. But regardless, we have a situation where we have one offense. This is not a multiple killing. Mr. Holley was charged and convicted with killing one person. We have one offense, one killing, one victim, and it is one offense of murder.
Counsel, isn't that the bottom line, whether or not there's one offense or multiple offenses?
Yes, I think so.
And the Supreme Court in Payne there was one victim and there were two capital murder convictions because the Supreme Court found that each conviction was for a separate offense.
Yes.
And if it's if it's the same offense, not a separate offense, then Blockberger doesn't apply because Blockberger, the analytical framework, is two separate offenses.
Yes. Yes. If we determine they're two separate, then we look to Blockberger to see if we can get the accused for both. And again, of course, the capital murder in the that particular Payne case, we have a couple Payne cases running throughout here. Of course, Payne, we note that that is a specific setting forth by the legislature in 31.
Like 14 factual
scenarios. All the different acts that it basically says, if you, you know, commit willful, deliberate, premeditated murder in the commission of rape, it's capital murder. If you do it in the commission of, you know, robbery, it goes on and on.
Or
and
killing judges.
Yes. Yes.
Mr. Moody.
Which is not before this court very much. But it is Mr. Holley's position that we don't reach Blockberger. We have one offense, and that the statute, the history, is clear. There was any intention.
The capital murder statutes, are they really adopting common law and adding punishments and gradations, or are they wholly supplanting the common law with an entirely statutory scheme, which would cut off the inference that the lawmakers intended the common law multiple punishment doctrine to apply? Now, they didn't go through all that in Payne, but attributing to the opinion that logic, that would make sense.
It would, and I'm sorry, I don't pretend to have the answer. I do know, and again, I keep hearkening back to the common law. All murders, indeed, initially all felonies, but then, of course, all murders were automatically punishable by death. We morphed away from that to say, have the code starting in 1819, where we say it's first degree if it's X, Y, or Z. Otherwise, it's second, and then we have the legislature, specifically created 18.231 to specifically, I don't know if it's to reserve or sever out, and I suppose in that sense it sort of, it harkens back to the common law, where again, we killed everybody if
they
committed
murder.
So
the point is, felony murder is still a common law doctrine with statutory gradations
yes.
and punishments, but it's not a statutory crime, whereas capital murder is clearly a statutory crime, wholly codified in the elements of the statute.
Yes, and specifically, again, as I just said, and as the court has indicated, creating separate, distinct offenses for the separate and distinct acts which are deemed to commit to comprise capital murder, whether it's a willful, deliberate, premeditated killing in the commission of, again, rape or robbery, any of those enumerated subsections. And this is why we have the fascinating law that basically upholds multiple death convictions and says, in effect, we can execute this person, you know, two or three or four times for killing one person.
Well, but of course, you're only going to have one execution as a practical matter.
Yeah.
So the practical significance of pain is really nothing.
Well, in that sense that we can only kill him once, we can impose multiple death sentences, but we can only execute him once. Yes, that would be correct. But again, that is the court's analysis of what the legislature did, what the legislature intended in specifically setting out all those sections under 31. And as I said, I think the law is pretty clear. It's repeated that if the legislature, we assume or presume that the legislature knows what it's doing and knows how to do what it wants to do or what it intends to do. Which again, just by example, the DUI manslaughter, it's clear they intend to authorize multiple punishments. Under 32, I see no such clear intent, not starting with the common law.
But that because in under 32, you're essentially just codifying the common law, whereas under 31, you're creating all sorts of separate
these capitals, yes.
But there are some historians who suggest that in 1796, when the Virginia legislature adopted what we now know as 18232, they were simply copying a statute that had been passed in Philadelphia. Does that change the analysis for you?
I'm sorry, I don't have an answer for that. I apologize. That, in as much of a nutshell as I can do in my time allotted, that is Mr. Holley's position. one of these convictions and the associated firearm conviction, the use of firearm, must fall. I would ask the court to consider, and I understand that where we have a conviction for a greater and a lesser, in fact, we're going to say second is a lesser, the lesser conviction must fall. I'd also just ask the court to consider what I argued on brief, which is the multiple instructions the jury had on grade of the offense. Now, I'd ask the court to consider, well, if they found him guilty of second, does that not suggest that they had a reasonable, they, the jury, had a reasonable doubt of his guilt as to first? But that almost runs me into a circular argument, and I'll just rest on brief.
Ms. Ringer, thank you very much for your argument.
I'm sorry?
Thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Tyson?
May it please the court, Virginia Tyson on behalf of the Commonwealth.
Ms. Tyson, let me jump in and ask you a question, because and for the purpose of my question, let's assume we've got a Blockburger issue here. I'm not sure we do, but just for the purpose of my question, let's assume that we do. Wouldn't you agree that the Blockburger jurisprudence is based basically on the assumption that where the General Assembly or the legislature doesn't indicate to the contrary, they don't intend multiple punishments for the same offense, but that can be overcome if it's clear the General Assembly did intend multiple punishments for the same offense, correct?
Well, I think that's right, although there doesn't need to be an express showing by the legislature of that authorization.
Wouldn't the flip side of that also be true? In other words, if the General Assembly clearly intended that you not be punished multiply for the same offense, that would reinforce any sort of analysis. You wouldn't really even need to get to a lesser included Blockburger test, if you will, if it's clear from the face of the statute the General Assembly intended for a single punishment where there might be multiple offenses involved. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
Well, when I'm looking at the language of 18.2-32, which it seems to me is fundamentally different from that of 31, which permits different types of capital murder, but in 32, the language of the legislature is that, quote, all murder other than capital murder and murder in the first degree is murder in the second degree. Now, why, in taking a plain reading of that phrase that I've just quoted, why can't one conclude that that's a clear expression of the General Assembly, that there's essentially three categories of murder, capital murder, first degree murder, and second degree murder? Pick one, not two, one, and therefore all murder has to fall into one of those categories and not more than one of those categories.
I think the reason that we don't do that is because that statute is not on a blank canvas at this point. There's a lot of case law that I think needs to be considered. And one of the things that I would like to point out is that one of the statutes that's discussed in these old cases, the statute from 1819, there was a preamble to that statute that referred to, and whereas, the several offenses which are included under this statute. And in the Wicks case, the Supreme Court said, well, that reference to several offenses doesn't mean that there are several offenses. It means there's this one offense.
Well, I think we can all agree that the Commonwealth attorney can charge any kind of theory that they want to. The question is how many punishments can be handed down for whatever, you know. So if a Commonwealth attorney wants to charge a felony first-degree murder theory and a standard second-degree murder theory, I don't think we would all agree that there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah.
The question becomes, if there's a conviction for more than one of those, how many punishments can be imposed? And you haven't cited a case, I'm not sure there is one, I couldn't find one, that suggests that language I just quoted means that you can actually impose multiple punishments for different theories of murder for the same, what amounts to the same homicide, if you will.
Where I was hoping to go with this is that back in 1819, several offenses, according to the Supreme Court, did not mean there were several offenses. However, under 18.2-31, and I'll grant you, is as a statutory offense, the preamble language reads, the following offenses shall constitute capital murder. And our Supreme Court says now that reference to several offenses means there are several offenses.
But that's in 31, not 32.
That's correct, Your Honor, but what my point is this. I don't think we can just rely on the ancient cases from the 19th century to say what our statutes mean today, because the Supreme Court has taken essentially the same phrase.
You can, if the ancient cases describe common law, and the offense we're talking about in 2014 is a common law offense. In fact, the statutes require us to do exactly that. Go back to the time of the common law, when it was adopted by the Commonwealth, determine what the then existing legal principles were and apply it today, unless a statute has changed that or a case law. So if the common law of felony murder required that there be only one punishment for felony murder and, let's say, a second degree murder charge, why would we not presume that the legislature intended that to remain the law until they changed it? And they obviously haven't changed it yet.
I think because there has been so much law written, I understand that
What law has been written that changes that one equation? I follow you in your arguments regarding the capital murder cases, but those are statutory crimes. They're not common law crimes. They've been wholly superseded by the statute. Have you found any case law or any precedent anywhere that says that a common law offense like felony murder, which has coupled with it a common law character as to the nature of the offense and whether or not multiple punishments can be opposed, has been changed simply by the codification of the gradation of the crime or the punishment for the crime?
I have not found a specific case that says that. But I would also say that under the common law, that the common law would not countenance having more than one murder conviction and sentence when you have one dead body. And we know that under Virginia law, under contemporary Virginia law, you can do that in a number of ways, including charging under the same statute, including charging under the same subsection of the same statute.
Are those cases, including Payne, statutory crimes?
Yes.
Isn't that the break in the logic? Because if we're dealing with a wholly supplanted crime, the common law has been wholly superseded by the words of a very exhaustive statute like the capital murder statutes, then I think that would be a fair argument and probably a correct argument that the common law doesn't carry forward and all the accoutrements to the common law do not carry forward in the statute because they've occupied the field with the statute. But we can't say that about felony murder, which is still a common law offense. We still look to the time of the founding to determine the nature of the elements of that offense. We don't look to any statute.
Which obviously the roots for all the crimes in 182-32 are in the common law, but it has been codified by statute. We do have a statute to follow. And I think it's very important that I think under the common law would not have countenanced having multiple convictions for one dead body. But I would also like to point out, the reason I think that could be important is that while this court has asked us to address the ancient common law cases and the common law underpinnings of 182-32, none of that was argued to the trial judge. The trial judge had to make a decision about how many convictions could stand. In fact, if you look in the appendix at the motion to set aside when the jury was still there, the judge said, I'm kind of inclined to grant this motion unless you can show me something that says I shouldn't. And the argument that the defense made to the trial judge was, well, we've got one incident, we've got one dead body, we can't have more than one conviction.
Well,
so
that was the argument under common law. Did they need to cite Lord Coke for that?
I think that it's not in keeping with the way procedure we normally have of letting the trial judge be the first one to determine the issues.
Well, to be perfectly frank, I'm not sure where we stand on that today.
Well, that is our basis of 5A18. That is our basis of 5A25, that we do give the trial judge the first chance. And to make an argument, a generic argument, that we can't have more than one murder conviction because we only have one incident with one dead body, is to me similar to making a Batson challenge and giving one reason and then coming up on appeal and giving another.
Well, Ms. Tyson, are you suggesting that the General Assembly has expressly determined that these are two separate offenses, or are you relying on Blockberger to reach that?
I have to rely on Blockberger. I have to rely on
if you rely on Blockberger, and in your brief, you seem to argue that the Commonwealth is not required to prove malice as a separate element of felony first-degree murder. Correct?
I agree with that.
But the Supreme Court has said that malice is an element of felony first-degree murder, and wouldn't.
Right. Except that it's not something that the Commonwealth has the burden to prove the element
they
of murder.
They prove it by proving by proving the felony. But it is an element of the offense.
It is, but I think that's also similar to the DUI vehicular manslaughter statute. The Commonwealth doesn't have to prove criminal negligence because they prove the DUI, which takes
but
care of that.
But if it is an element of the offense, then your Blockberger analysis falls apart.
No, it doesn't fall apart because what we look at are the elements that must be proven, and the element that must be proven in first-degree felony murder.
Well, there's semantics here, it seems to me. Judge Petty's just pointed out, it sounded like you agreed that malice is an element of all murder, period. It's an element. Now, it can be proved by the Commonwealth a number of different ways. It can be proved by showing a state of mind that indicates malice. It can be shown by proving the commission of an underlying qualifying felony that supplies the malice as a matter of law. But either way, it's still an element that has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt to the fact finder's satisfaction.
In fact, proof of premeditation proves malice.
I'm sorry?
Proof of premeditation proves malice. You don't instruct the jury as to malice in a first-degree murder, because if they find the killing was premeditated, they of necessity have found that it's malicious.
But the difference in first-degree felony murder is that the proof is of the felony, and there's no requirement for a proof in regular old murder. You don't have to prove the felony.
Wooden says neither premeditation nor an intent to kill is an element of felony murder, but malice is. So if it's an element, and Blockberger is all based on an analysis of the abstract elements of the offense, I don't see how you get to that argument.
I think that's because of what must be proven in order to establish that crime. And first-degree felony murder.
Is it a fair reading of 18.232? The first phrase talks about murder one, and obviously you have to prove malice. And then the felony murder simply gives alternate ways to prove malice. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're separate offenses, it's just an alternate way to prove malice for the same offense. What's wrong with that reasoning?
I think that was the analysis under these older cases that the court asked us to address. But I think that the law has evolved quite a bit since the 19th century with the various ways, various types of murder that we have, and the fact that we can have, when there are different elements, which we contend there are different elements from first-degree felony murder and regular murder, that it is permissible. Now, even under the capital murder statute, if you've got greater and lesser, you cannot have more than one conviction. And I think we learned that from Andrews. But when you have separate elements to prove, then you do have more than one offense. And whereas the capital statute mentions the several offenses, just like the code from 1819, I think that shows a difference in thinking from
Your argument then would mean, if it was taken to its logical conclusion, that you could be convicted of premeditated first-degree murder and second-degree murder, because you don't have to independently prove malice in premeditated first-degree murder. All you have to do is prove premeditation.
No, I would disagree with that, because obviously second-degree murder is a lesser-included offense of first-degree murder under any test.
But Judge Petty's point is, we infer malice from the premeditated act in first degree, right? We also infer malice in felony murder because of the nature of the felony. So the fact that we infer malice doesn't mean that malice is not an element. It clearly is an element. It may be proved differently, but it's still an element, and which is also Judge Frank's point. How do you respond to that?
That the burden of proof is for the felony, and there's an imputation of malice from that felony, and that's the requirement. The requirement is to prove the felony.
Ms. Tyson, what is malice? Define, and how would you instruct the jury as to what they must find?
For malice, how the jury was instructed here, or how would I'm thinking there is a malice instruction in here. I know that was quite a point in the recent Hughley case with regard to the evil mind and whether that was required. The malice aforethought certainly is an ancient proposition of... And
it's necessary for murder as opposed to manslaughter.
Yes, sir.
Voluntary manslaughter is an intentional killing. But we get hung up with the word malice.
I mean, it's criminal law, Judge Jones, used to teach this stuff. It's criminal law 101 that malice is an element of all murder, period. Now, you can get there in a number of ways, as Judge Petty and Judge Kelsey alluded to. Prove malice by proving the evil heart, the state of mind, or you can prove it by showing an intent and the actual commission of an underlying qualifying offense, such as robbery.
And again, I would make the comparison to the criminal negligence that the Commonwealth does not have to prove in a vehicular manslaughter because the DUI takes the place of that.
They have to prove it, but it's proven by the proof of the underlying crime.
By the underlying crime.
Well, all of your citations to the second degree felony murder cases involve a crime that's unintentional. And the same is true with your manslaughter analogy. Felony second degree murder is the unintended killing of an individual during the commission of a felony. So those cases don't really pour over or carry over to a first degree murder.
No, well, and of course the am I over my time?
You are, but you may conclude.
Oh, thank you. I guess the point I was making with the second degree murder is, I mean, the unintended killing. And those are in fact, the jury was even instructed on that here and rejected that. So we would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you very much, Ms. Tyson, for your argument. Thank you again, Ms. Ringer, for yours and an